This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A standard part of any Grateful Dead concert is called drums. Everyone in the band leaves the stage, except the two drummers, Bill Kreutzmann and Mickey Hart, who play a free-form improvisation on an array of drums and percussion instruments gathered from around the world. The percussion sounds from remote regions were brought into the band by Mickey Hart, who has been collecting instruments and recording drummers from around the world for the past 19 years. Though the Grateful Dead seem to be constantly on tour, Hart has found time to study the historical and spiritual traditions of his instrument. He's written a new book called Drumming at the Edge of Magic, A Journey into the Spirit of Percussion. He's also been producing a series of recordings for Rykodisc called The World. The newest record in the World series features the music of Mickey Hart himself. It's called At the Edge, and it also features some of the percussionists he's recorded for his series, such as Olatunji from Nigeria, Zakir Hussain of India, and the Brazilian-born Ayerto. Fellow Grateful Dead member Jerry Garcia makes an appearance, along with Hart's sons Taro and Creek. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke with Hart. They begin with music from his new recording.
Father and your mother, I think, were actually champion rudimental drummers.
True.
So did you? But he wasn't around. He left before you were born.
Yeah, he left when I was, when I was just a baby.
So did you hear stories about him when you were?
Well, yeah, he was a world champion rudimental drummer. He had won in 1939 with my mother, and so he was like a drum god. You know, when I go to competitions, I'd hear his name and listen to the stories. He was a legend, so it was sort of it was growing up in his shadow, but he was never around. So I would just, you know, I made my own way through the drum corps competitions.
Did hearing those stories about him make you want to be a drummer?
Oh, of course. You know, you wanted to idolize your dad. You know, you wanted to be like your father. And I really didn't have much choice. He left me a drum pad and a couple of sticks. That's all we really had, you know. And then he just disappeared for 18 years. So all I had was the pad, and that was my father. And so I would practice the pad all the time. You know, I would just sit in the corner, actually in the closet, and use the closet as a resonator and make it louder. And I would just sit there, and I would practice the rudiments. My mom would show me rudiments every week, and eventually it all sort of came together for me.
Did you somehow have this feeling that drumming would, that if you drummed someday, would lead you to your father?
No, I never really thought that when I was really little, until I was about 17 or 18 when I found a picture of him in a brochure, and I tracked him down in California, and we united for a few years before he died. But no, it was mostly just an urge and a compulsion and something that was just drawing me into its, sucking me into its web, you know, it was pulling me.
The drumming.
The drums, yeah. The power of the drums just sucked me up. Yeah, I had no choice. I was just following my muse, you know. That was the way it was.
Can you tell us about these drumsticks he left you?
Oh, they were called snakewood sticks. They were South American wood, and they had little silver ends to them, butts, and they were weighted really heavily, and they were just magic sticks. They were very heavy and very well balanced, and he won them in the championships, and I used them in my competition. They were just artifacts from another age, you know. You don't build sticks like that anymore. You know, thousands of dollars worth of sticks, a pair of sticks. Really finely honed instruments.
So when did you start taking drumming really seriously and begin to really see yourself as a drummer and know that this was something you were going to do for a long time?
About 3 or 4 years old, I imagine. When I hit the pad, I knew from the first time I hit the pad, it was that rush of that first rush of noise. I knew that I loved the drum, I loved the sound, and I like hitting things, and I like the report.
So when you were a little kid, you would be home by yourself a lot pounding away?
Oh, of course. That's the way you learn an instrument, you know, many hours of just solitude, you know, and finding the voice of the drum and finding your voice and finding how they both go together, finding the sweet spot, you know, and that's what you look for. A musician always looks for the sweet spot, the place where it sounds just really juicy and good and the right place to be at that time. That's what a musician looks for.
How old were you when you got your first drum? So far, you just had this little practice
I was about 11 years old, you know, before I got a real drum set. And then I started learning how to play the set, which was different than the single drum. And then I started to dance on the drums. And that led into rock and roll and jazz, big band, and so forth, and Grateful Dead.
You quit high school and joined the Air Force. Why did you do that?
Well, I had gone through high school, and there was no place left to go. I mean, we had won all the championships, and I wanted to be a man drummer. You know, I had it with being a kid drummer. I was in the all-state bands, and there was no place to go. And the Air Force had the best drum and bugle corps in the world, in Washington, D.C., the Blue Eagles. So I thought by joining the Air Force, it would just pop me up into the big leagues, and I would be up there with the big guys, the national champions, the seniors. And it was a place to go for a teacher, I thought, or just actually field experience every day, playing the drum, marching the troops, playing at night, and so forth and so on. So, and it was part of my rite of passage, just becoming a man. You know, this is what happens. You know, you leave the street, and you join the Air Force, you drum, you grow up.
So was it a good place for you to work on your
drumming?
Oh,
it was wonderful. It was wonderful. I mean, I had 4 years of, it was a blissful 4 years for me. I learned a lot. I learned to drum hard, and also I learned martial arts. That's what I did in the service.
You kind of mentioned this earlier, but just before you went overseas, when you were in the Air Force, you actually got together with your father. And could you tell us a little more about what that meeting was like?
Well, when I first found him, I found out he was in the Savings and Loan Institute in San Bernardino.
How did you find? Were you trying to track him down?
No, I found a brochure when I was in basic training. I found a brochure in his in the band room, and I contacted the gentleman whose picture he had put. I mean, when I contacted the fellow who wrote the or published the brochure, Remo Belli in North Hollywood, and he told me my father was in a savings and loan.
Now, the brochure had your father on it, or is
it was him holding a stick saying, "I've tried these drum heads, these Weather King drum heads, and they're the best in the world." He used to practice on these heads and sort of dent them when he was when they were learning how to make plastic drum heads. This Remo developed the heads, so my dad used to test it for him, and they were friends. I didn't know this. And I went to see him, and then he led me to my father, and I walked in on him and told him who I was, and we drummed all day, and we became friends.
What do you mean you drummed all day?
I gave him a pair of sticks. I had a pair of sticks, and we just sat there and played the standard classics.
Drums there, or would you be
no,
on
just
the
on
desk?
The desk. You only need is a pair of drumsticks. You can drum on anything.
Do you carry drumsticks with you everywhere?
Everywhere, yeah. Of course. If they're not near me, I know that I'm losing my instrument. You know, if I can't reach around in my bag or in my car or wherever I am and feel a pair of drumsticks, I feel uneasy. You know, I mean, that means that you're losing your instrument. It's too far away from you. You have to have it with you all the time just to remind you, you know, what you're doing.
My guest is Mickey Hart, and he's one of the drummers of the Grateful Dead. And he's just written a book called Drumming at the Edge of Magic. So how did you end up joining the Grateful Dead? I mean, you came back from the Air Force. You were in New York, and the Grateful Dead was
well,
a
I
band.
Came out to the West Coast after leaving the Air Force and started a music store with my dad called Drum City, Hart Music, in San Francisco. And then I met Billy. I was hanging out with Count Basie's drummer, Sonny Payne, and Basie was playing the Fillmore. And I was down there, and someone introduced me and Billy, who was the drummer for the newly formed Grateful Dead. And we hit it off really well. And I started teaching him some of the drum rudiments. And he invited me to play with the band one night. And that was it. You know, after it was all over, everybody looked around and realized this was the Grateful Dead. And that's where it all started.
In your book, you tell this story of how that night you met Bill Kreutzmann and you guys were out in the parking lot talking and that you were drumming on the cars.
Oh, yeah. We had a few beers, and then we went around the city until 6 o'clock in the morning playing on everything. The city became our instrument. It was the night. It was male bonding, you know. Drums is the way drummers bond. And then we played on cars and on tin cans and anything we could. We just had a blast that night, and we knew that we were brothers of the drum right then and there. We just shared that same groove, and we've been friends ever since, 25 years now.
So the very first time that you played with the Grateful Dead, can you tell us about that? Like, how was drumming with the Dead different from what you'd been doing? And
well, the Grateful Dead had a certain kind of breath to it. It would breathe like an animal. You know, it was live. It was organic, and it wasn't metric in the sense that it was one beat followed the next exactly like the beat before it. It took on its own personality, and it was thousands of people, you know, obviously ingesting strange substances, playing this living music, and I couldn't believe it. It was really loud and way out of hand. And I said, "Jesus, this is wonderful. This is for me." And I just jumped in and tried to hang on, you know. And then all of a sudden, this force field took you away and it sucked you up in its jet stream. And then the next thing, you know, it was 6 hours later, and everybody was standing there looking at each other. When the smoke cleared, we were all smiling. You know, it was unbelievable. You know, what just had gone down. It was magic. You know, we were all taken away on this little magic carpet ride, and the groove was strong enough that it would eat the audience. It was literally eating the audience. It was very big. So we decided that this would be something that we could do for the rest of our lives. You know, once you see something that strong and that powerful, you just can't put it back in the closet.
You were a master of the rudimental drumming technique, and so did you find that helped you because it gave you a good foundation, or was it really kind of a hindrance that you had to get rid of?
Well, it was both. It was I had to lose the martial feeling and get into the rock and roll and swing jazz feeling, but it also gave me precision. It also gave me focus and power and incredible amounts of endurance. I had to march the troops 5 miles every day back and forth in the Air Force, so I had a lot of power. So it had its pros and cons. There are good things about it and bad things about it, but what happened was it mutated. The style mutated into the present style, which is a bit of both worlds. Of all the worlds, as it should be. You know, it's a piece of me, what I've been through and my collective experience over the years. It's not anybody else's. It's my personal signature. I don't try to be like anybody else. I never could. It wasn't for me. It would be like Buddy Rich or Gene Krupa. Yet they were my idols. And I hope that I'd be an original sound. And that's what I try to do.
So in the Grateful Dead, you have two drummers, you mm-hmm. and Bill Kreutzmann, right. Which is still kind of unusual. Most bands don't have two mm-hmm. drummers. Can you tell us something about the interplay between the two of you? Well, do you each play really differently?
There's an incredible kind of nuance that we can both form together. We try to make it like one big drum section. There's power, obviously, two people playing a unison part or semi-unison can get. And then there's the rhythmic possibilities we can achieve by splitting up the rhythm. He can take the six, I can take the four, or what have you. And the rhythmic possibilities are enormous. They're unlimited. It allows the guitarist and the keyboard a springboard, a place to take a rhythm and go off with it on any kind of a rhythmic level. So there's power and there's also nuance that's available within the intricacies governing the pulse. Billy and I are sort of tied at the heart, so we beat as one big organism. It's sometimes it's an overwhelming rush of rhythm and noise.
Okay, I want to play just a little something from an old Dead album. And this is Alligator, which, mm-hmm. according to you, is the first song that you ever played with the Dead professionally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's got this really big instrumental jam in the middle. And so we're going to listen to just a little bit of that now.
Okay.
Creepy alligator.
That's the Grateful Dead doing Alligator. You called your CD At the Edge.
Yeah.
It's a phrase that you use a lot in your book. What does that mean to you?
Well, there's the edge to everything. You know, it's the place between consciousness and unconsciousness or subconsciousness or whatever. It's not necessarily the music that you can chew gum to or walk around without participating in. It appeals to the spirit side. It doesn't appeal to the, it's not the easy listening music. So I'm after something different. And these songs or soundscapes came from my time exploring on the edge, you know, doing the research for the book, which involved finding out the power of these ancient instruments. These are my dream songs. These are the things I brought back from that time at the edge.
One of the drums that you write about is the tar, and that's an Egyptian drum. And you got one from Hamza El Din, who's a musician from Egypt. He gave you one of these. And you write in the book that you collect them and that you used to take one with you everywhere because having one close at hand steadied you. So what is it about the tar that has that effect?
Well, the tar is the only real romance drum that I know. It's quiet. You play it with your fingertips. And it's an instrument of the desert. And it calms me. It's a meditative kind of a thing. I sit there and I meditate when I play it, and it's very soft, and it's romance, because you play the high overtones of it. You don't beat it. You gently tap it, and you just coax the sound out. So it's a sort of a magical drum that it appeals to the quiet inside. It's more ecstatic than it is trance-like. You know, where there's trance, you need loud music. In the ecstatic, quiet moments, you use a quiet drum that appeals to a whole other side of you.
Well, let's listen to the tar. And this is off of a record which you produced called Egypt. You made the recordings over there, and it features Hamza El Din and the tar. Write about certain drums as being very powerful. What's the most powerful drum, and what is it about it that makes it more powerful than some
Well, some
other
of the drums from the Tibetan drums, the Damarus, which are made from the skulls of humans and consecrated, they're powerful drums. I mean, they're medicine drums. Any drum that's used for religious rites has some power to it. And that means that it affects you in a way that allows you to transcend, to become conscious. That's what drumming is all about, especially the religious parts of it. It's some drums allow you to move in and out of the trance states and allow you to allow for possession, for what have you. It seems like the power of the sound of the drum and the redundancy of the beat are the things that trigger you into the other states of awareness. So the drum has been used throughout history, shamanic performance. It took me back to the mother goddess cultures when I found out that the mother goddess and the drum, there was a direct relation between the mother goddess and the drum. Now, this is 40,000 years ago. And the mother goddess religions, which lasted until about 500 AD, were all trance-driven possession cults. All these women, you know, and men, of course, were using the drum and the trance to drive that the mother goddess society. That's the center of the religion. When I found out this, I mean, I was just aghast, because here we have our earliest incarnation of rhythm and rapture.
Do you ever feel that you've been at a disadvantage being an American, that you've missed out on something really important because you were born into this modern culture? And do you sometimes wish that maybe you'd come from Africa or India and that you could have followed just this one uncluttered path?
Yes, all the time. You know, I mean, I always suspected that we were bankrupt and we weren't really given our musical legacy. And then when I went into the library for the first time and looked and popped up percussion and wanted to see all the books about it, and there weren't any there, I realized there was a giant gap in the record, in the scholarly record. And that's what first put me on to writing this book. I was wondering why there's a million books on violins and pianos and nothing on percussion. Well, there were things written on percussion, but they were in little tiny isolated little pockets all out there in the archives, and they were mostly not in English. And they were written by scholars that didn't think it was important enough to translate it back into English. So that's what started me on the road to find out where this heritage was. I mean, the Africans are born with it. You know, they know everything about it. Almost every other culture has their history, but not here, not in the West. And I wondered why. So this was the book, was the quest to unlock those secrets, you know, to find out what was the power of this drum? Where did it come from? How? Why? And why are we still, you know, we still pounding skin to get this kind of a feeling? And this is what these things, this is what the research unlocked for me.
Great. Mickey Hart, thanks a lot for
coming. My pleasure. Back. Thank you.
Mickey Hart spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. His new book is Drumming at the Edge of Magic. Hart's new CD on Ricoh Disc is called At the Edge. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.